From listener-supported KTOO, welcome to Juno Afternoon's Rainy Day Conversations, broadcasting from the homelands of the Akwan. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. Gunath Cheesh, Hawa, Toeksiknusum, Salamat. Thank you for sharing your time with us. Today, it's our Rainy Day Conversation featuring author Betsy Longenbaugh. Betsy has had a lifelong love of murder mysteries, and upon retirement, she and her husband, Ed Schoenfeld, began researching and uncovering details of murders and mysteries in Southeast Alaska. They continue to give tours and talks around these subjects, but Betsy has also authored two books with a third on the way. We unravel the mystery of Betsy Longenbaugh on a Juno afternoon rainy day conversation. Warning, during our chat today, we may discuss details of various crimes, murders, and other adult theme topics. Betsy, Gunath Cheesh, Ha'igudi, thank you so much for coming into the studio today. It's a pleasure to have you here. Wasa Iati, how are you today?
I'm doing great. And it's a perfect day to do a rainy day broadcast because it's a rainy day.
We are recording this on a rainy day. That is true. It's a welcome to spring in Juno.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Okay, so I just want to dive right in, and I want to talk about what inspired the interest in uncovering the details of these mysteries.
I was retired, freshly retired, that was about 7 years ago, and volunteering at the Juno Douglas City Museum. It was a slow Monday. Mondays were my volunteer days, and it was always very slow. So I sort of poked around to see what else I could do, and I came across a collection of Bob DeArmond's musings on historic events. What he would do is he would collect, sort of do a day in Juno and then collect different things that happened on that particular day throughout the years. And I came across a firsthand account, in other words, a contemporary news article about the arrest of Robert Stroud, who went on to become the Birdman of Alcatraz, probably the most famous killer that's ever come out of Juno. And I thought, this is really interesting, but I've never found that story as compelling, perhaps, as other stories that I've come across, not in those days, none of the. I just thought, this is interesting, but I'm sure there are other murders that happened here. How could I find that out? So I called the State Historic Library, and they told me about something called chroniclingamerica.com, which is a fantastic Library of Congress website that has digitized newspapers from around the country and is searchable by word. Now, at that point, they'd only digitized up to about 1920 here in Juno, and they don't digitize all the newspapers, but the main ones they had. So it was winter, and I sat down and spent 3 months going through the Library of Congress Chronicling America website for Juno newspapers, searching for the word murder. And I ended up, with Ed's help, creating a spreadsheet cataloging the murders I found here in Juno. Mm. And altogether, between 1900 and 1920, I found about 60. And in the 1920s, there was a ship captain and fisherman here named, in Juno, named Kinky. That was his nickname, Lloyd Bear. And Kinky cataloged newspapers. And Kinky had, starting in around 1920s and until his death in the, I think, early 60s, had created an index cards, typed index cards of different topics. And one of them was murder.
Wow.
And so he had collected, I think there were like 5 index cards on murder. And so what he would do is have the date of the newspaper, the name of the newspaper, and a short description of what happened. That plus the Chronicling America research I did ended up coming up with about 80 murders in those first 50 or so years. And then we decided to start doing these presentations. And we started by doing a presentation on how the media looked at murders and mm-hmm. basically how the empire, which has always been in existence in one form or another here in Juno, had looked at murders in the community, how they covered them. And of course, they were racist and sexist and dismissive of people who were not white men. But all of that told us something as much as anything else did. That was the first presentation we did at the Juno Douglas Museum, just sort of how people looked at murders in those days. And we pulled out a few samples. And some of them were just so interesting, I wanted to find out more. So we decided to do three presentations, each one on a particular murder. So I went to my spreadsheet and thought, which of these are the ones that are most interesting? Of course, the top one was when we discovered we had a serial killer here operating out of Juno. So that was pretty easy to pick. We also discovered that the superintendent of the Treadwell Mine, probably the most powerful person in the community of either Juno or Douglas at the time, had killed a man literally on the town plaza in the middle of the morning and gotten away with it.
Wow.
And so that was another just absolutely great story. And then another story, I think this one of the first ones we did was a vaudeville entertainer who was killed aboard a boat. And so those stories then became these presentations, and we enjoyed doing them. And so we kept doing them. We moved out of the Juno City Museum venue to our church as church fundraisers. And pretty much every year except the depth of COVID, we've done three presentations as fundraisers for the museum. And those presentations then became the kernel for the nonfiction book that I wrote. And we are now creating kernels for the second nonfiction book, which I just finished writing.
You, Betsy, have had a lifelong interest in murder mysteries.
Right.
So it had to start before retirement. So when
did... Oh, it so did.
Were you reading like the Hardy Boys or
no,
Nancy Drew?
No.
How did it start for you?
Nancy Drew was a book my mother did not approve of, the Nancy Drew books. My mom, who had a bookstore here in Juneau for many years, was, of course, an inveterate reader. And when I best knew her, she had us when she was quite young. She was a young woman when I best knew her. She loved murder mysteries. So she introduced me to some of the classic British murder mystery writers, Dorothy Sayers and Marjorie Allingham and Josephine Tay, people who just wrote what I've discovered is an unusual combination of fascinating characters and fascinating stories. Usually you get really great characters and maybe an okay mystery, or a really great mystery and maybe okay characters. But all these women wrote these just compelling stories. Meanwhile, I would go to visit her mother, who was really into true crime. So at my grandmother's house, I found these, what we would now call, frankly, ridiculous true crime magazines. That were so sensational and absurd, but also sort of fueled that interest in not only this idea of a fictional mystery, but the idea of real mysteries. And so I kept reading mysteries all my adult life.
And how did you find the media coverage of murders, right? And these mysteries? Because I think there's a difference between sort of the media coverage and then the pulp magazines, which you're talking
Absolutely.
About. And but also, you're still talking about the reflection of the time where they may not be telling the story. We're still having this problem today, right? They're not telling the story of necessarily the minority or the unrepresented voices, and those kind of get pushed down. Do you find that in when you're looking
Absolutely.
Back at this microfiche? What do you see? Like, how does it present itself?
The blatant racism in early newspapers was, frankly, there's no other word than absolutely appalling. Having said that, newspapers of the time didn't have trained writers. Trained journalism didn't actually happen until the 1950s. My aunt and uncle owned the Daily Sentinel in Sitka and still put it out in their 80s. And my aunt was one of the first people I ever knew who had actually a degree in journalism. That was a very unusual degree to have at the time. And so the people that they hired into these newspapers just wrote what seemed interesting to them. There was no guidance that they were being provided. For example, most newspapers now have really strict guidance about how you cover suicide. I know at the Empire, the rule was always you didn't cover suicide unless it was in a very public setting. So if somebody jumps off the bridge and, you know, everybody on the bridge sees it, that's a newspaper story. But if somebody does it in the middle of the night and they just find out about it later, that is not a newspaper story. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
So they say they'll report that that person died but not go into the suicide. Well, in those days, oh, my gosh, they would give details. They would print out suicide notes.
Oh,
I mean,
wow.
They just had this ridiculous, and I think looking at it from our vantage point, really unethical approach to talking about people in the trauma that they were experiencing.
I feel like we're now, like you said, we're getting there, right? Mm-hmm. People see the systemic issues with mm-hmm. how things are reported, yep. And we also have a better understanding of mental health yep. and that relationship to each other and to the world and to the problems that people might be facing. So that is good that there are some journalistic standards mm-hmm. that are mm-hmm. in place now.
Right.
I'm imagining that you see all kinds of things in when you're uncovering this microfiche and the various different things that you see. And like
absolutely.
You said, I want to bring this up because this is you put this in the acknowledgement of your of the first book. Murder is a fascinating topic to me because it shows us at our worst, sometimes shows us at our best, and usually involves a puzzle needing solving. And I think that's interesting because you're seeing the reporters of the time maybe being at their worst, as well as the people doing the murdering and the mysterying, whatever it is.
I think that's a really good comment.
Yeah.
And it wasn't, of course, just the reporters, but it was the other people involved
yeah.
in the judicial system. You have a system for many, many, many years, actually, until we became a state, where there were coroner's juries would determine a cause of death.
Mm.
And up until, I would guess, based on what I'm looking at in terms of regular jury selection, probably up until the 20s, 30s, those coroner's juries were always six white men.
Mm.
So six white men would be called to the site of a body. That was the preference, is that they would actually see the body in situ. And at that point, they would determine whether it was accidental, suicide, murder, and the cause of death.
Mm.
So that all alone is showing an enormous bias mm-hmm. because just the fact that we have six white men. But we also are in a time in a community where those six white men are not going to be jumping to any conclusion that isn't fully drawn out before them.
Mm.
So do I believe there were lots of murders that were occurring that were not called murders? Absolutely. And just as today, because of the hotbed of the internet, I think there are deaths that are being called murders that probably aren't
mm.
because of this overwhelming interest and the fascination, which, you know, to everything, the extremes are poor. The extremes of having six white men determine whether a person died or was murdered or committed suicide, it's pretty easy to see how there can be extremes to that. You have a husband saying she fell down the stairs. You have a doctor saying she fell down the stairs. Do you talk to anybody who says he hated her, he beat her all the time? Probably not.
You know, we're talking about the pulp magazines and sort mm-hmm. of this fascination mm-hmm. with mm-hmm. the details of a murder. But you are also in a place where you are also trying to give voice to the victims. Like that becomes a big part of the story for you is like you're talking about, the wife who ended up getting pushed down the stairs. What was actually going on for her?
Right.
And how difficult is it to uncover the details for the victims in these? Because we're talking about crimes that were committed, you know, 100 years ago or, you know, somewhere in that zone, 60 to 100 years ago. Do you find details about that, about the people, the victims?
I do, and sometimes in very unexpected ways. The most difficult story that's in the new book, the second book, is about a killing in Petersburg, and it's the only time I ever done a story involving a child. It was a four-year-old girl and her mother who were chopped to death, actually.
Mm.
And it was during the heyday of what they called the second gold rush, the salmon canning industry. It was done at the cannery in cannery housing. It was the wife and daughter of the cannery foreman who was Chinese. The people who were witnesses involved with the crime were either Filipino, Chinese, or Japanese. There may have also been Korean. There's some Korean surnames, but nobody ever said Korean. And I really wanted to find out more about this little girl and her mother, because the most invisible people in the world in those days was the mother of in a minority relationship, and much less a four-year-old girl. And I spent a whole lot of time trying to track down even a death certificate for them. And I do this through Ancestry.com, and I've also gone out to the vital statistics here and looked at death certificates here. And this one involved my calling the state of Washington, because they were buried in Washington State. And although the death certificates didn't exist here, Petersburg death certificates apparently are few and far between from that era. I was able to find out where they were buried in Washington State and that they were buried together. And through newspaper accounts, found out that her husband remarried. He actually had the child who survived that attack was an infant boy in a crib. The husband remarried and ended up having a number of other children, and actually ended up in Seattle running the theater in Chinatown. There's a lovely article in him, about him in one of the Seattle newspapers about his giving reporters a tour of this new facility. And what a great guy he was. And I mean, and he ended up becoming a pretty prominent businessman. And consequently, I was able to find out more about him.
In my mind,
yeah,
I was thinking he was the murderer.
No.
But he's not.
He was not. Almost certainly not.
Oh.
It was a cannery worker who had developed a passion for this young woman.
I see.
And she rejected him.
Mm-hmm.
And when I first heard about this case, I was very suspicious of the conviction, because there was a much ado about the fact that the killing had to have been done by a left-handed person. And initially, the reporting was there was only one left-handed person in Petersburg. And then initially, that rolled back to there was only one left-handed person working at the cannery.
Oh.
I don't believe that, but I did find out a lot about left-handed people, including the reason the word sinister comes from being left-handed.
How is that?
Well, left-handed people were considered to be just inherently there was an evilness about them.
Wow.
And I was also being from a family of origin where three of my family members of the six of us were left-handed. I was shocked to hear that only 5% of people are actually left-handed. I thought it would have been much higher than that. And I'm sure there was more than one person at the cannery who was left-handed.
Yeah, that's the number that was in my head was 5%.
It is.
Because
you're absolutely right.
My mother and my partner, that she's left-handed as well. And,
yep.
And so I remember that 5% number, mm-hmm. but that's still the case.
So finding out that the mom and child were buried together was comforting to me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It was very comforting to me. And that to also find out as I read more and more about that case, that by a weird happenstance, I think they did choose the right person to convict. was also kind of a relief.
Right.
Because it was such a dreadful crime.
We'll take a quick break. I'm talking with author and true crime enthusiast Betsy Longenbaugh. You can find more information on upcoming presentations and talks and her books at truecrimealaska.com. This is Juno Afternoons, Rainy Day Conversations. Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Alaska Airlines Club 49. Membership information available at club49hub.com. From KTOO. Let's continue our rainy day conversation with true crime author Betsy Longenbaugh. Warning, this talk does include adult topics around murder, sexual assault, and other criminal activity. Betsy, let's talk about your superhero origin story just a little bit. We'll go back. You grew up in Sitka. Can you tell us a little bit about growing up in Sitka?
Yeah. I moved there in 1963 with my dad, who'd been stationed there with the Public Health Service. He was a surgeon. And the Public Health Service had gotten peeved with my father because he had gotten orders to Staten Island, very prestigious orders, and he turned them down. He didn't want them. So I think they sent him off to Sitka because they saw it as a punishment for his turning off down these prestigious orders. But both my parents had grown up in very rural Southwest, and when they showed up in Sitka, they just felt completely at home.
Mm.
I remember my mother saying the first time she went shopping in Sitka, she did as she had done in Baltimore, where we'd moved from. He'd been at Johns Hopkins, worn her gloves and hat to go shopping, came back from shopping and said, "I'm never going to have to do that again. Yay!" So I grew up on Mount Edgecombe, which is now a defunct community. It was the collection of islands where the public health hospital was situated and is now where the brand new search hospital is situated.
Mm-hmm.
And I grew up in that collection of islands, and we would go to what we called Sitka Side, take the ferry from Mount Edgecombe, this collection of islands, over to Sitka to go to church and do grocery shopping, etc. So it was a very rural and idyllic existence, frankly. It was just lovely.
Yeah.
And then my dad went into private practice when I was starting middle school, and we moved over to Sitka, and he remained in private practice there until his death. So I grew up in Sitka. I moved away after graduating from high school in 1974. And for a long time, when I would take friends to Sitka, I'd say, let me give you the 1974, you know, tour of Sitka. It was post-bridge, but Sitka, fortunately for me, hasn't changed a great deal. I still have family there. My mother, after moving there with her husband, ended up bringing two sisters along.
Oh, wow.
Two of her sisters moved there. One, my aunt, and with her husband, both of whom were working for the Associated Press, and ended up buying the Sitka Sentinel and moving to Sitka. And my other aunt, who came up to visit her two sisters and married a local boy. So I have lots of cousins, and my two aunts are still living. And so I have a lot of lovely connections to Sitka still.
And you started working at the paper.
I did.
Like in high school.
I did, yeah.
A little Nepo baby, right?
Yeah, because I totally was.
Because
totally
your aunt was running the paper.
I know.
But how did that get started?
I think I was looking for work. I always, at age 12, our parents took us aside and said, you are no longer getting an allowance. You have to go work for your living.
Mm.
And we were at that point expected to buy our own clothes. And there's nothing really wrong with that. I worked at my dad's clinic, another Nepo job. I worked delivering newspapers. I worked at the library. I just did whatever work I could find. And my aunt and uncle were kind enough to offer me a job, which is how I ended up deciding I loved journalism and going to school to get my journalism degree.
Did you start working, writing stories, or were you just...
Oh, no. Yeah. I was a dog's body. I basically did whatever they wanted me to do. I didn't start writing newspaper articles until after I graduated. I think it was, honestly, my aunt.
Hmm.
My aunt had five living children and raised them at the newspaper. And to me, this was a very foreign concept. It was not just to me, it was a foreign concept in the 1970s to be able to go to work and have your children there.
Mm.
That was just not, that was something that was not done. My mother didn't go back to work by her bookstore until her youngest was in high school, because you were expected as a mother and wife to stay home and be with your kids. So Sandy made things seem possible to me.
Mm.
And I loved the politics. I was really interested in the economy and how little communities fit together. And it wasn't so much crime at that time. It was more like how communities work together.
Sort of the sociological aspects,
absolutely.
Right? How a group lived together. Yeah.
And economic also.
Yeah,
I was
economic,
really interested in, you know, where the money came from and how it was decided it was going to be spent and mm-hmm. all of that. So after I graduated with my degree, I ended up back in Sitka working for the paper and absolutely loving it. I remember waking up one morning and just saying, I have the best job in the entire world. I loved everything about it.
Mm-hmm.
I was the only newspaper reporter for some period of time. They got a second one. And also the only photographer. I can't tell you what fun it was. It was just supremely fun, supremely fun. And Sandy and Thad were amazing and are amazing editors and mentors. They were just... They're just amazing people. I can't imagine how many reporters they've mentored at the Sitka Sentinel over the years, but they're remarkable. So
when you went off to college, University of Oregon, right?
Actually, I started at Oregon State University for two years, and then U of O
for two years.
I graduated from U of O.
You graduated from
U
of O. Okay. Did you know when you were getting that journalism degree that you were going to move back to Sitka?
No, not at all. In fact, I got married when I was in college. And the marriage broke up a year after I finished college, and that's how I ended up back in Sitka.
I see.
Okay. I had intended to stay with my husband. He was an Oregonian and probably remain in Oregon. So the first paper I worked for was an Oregon paper.
Okay.
Before coming back to home.
And then you did that for a long time, right? And then when did you move to Juneau?
Well, I worked for the Sentinel, I'm thinking about 4 or 5 years. I then got offered a job with Senator Frank Murkowski's office in Washington, D.C.
Oh.
As an assistant press secretary. And that was an exciting opportunity for me.
Yeah.
And I took it, and I had a fantastic time. It was his first term. He had a bunch of neophyte staff people. We were all young. We loved hanging out with each other. It was an incredible experience. Washington, D.C. was amazing. Worked there for a couple of years, and I missed home. I missed home a lot. So I started applying for different jobs in Alaska, and I got a call from a woman I knew at the Empire who said, you should apply here.
Hmm.
And I thought, really? No, she really should apply here. You should. She would call me up every few weeks and tell me I should apply there. And I thought, do I want to go to Juneau? I don't know. Because Juneau and Sitka are traditionally sports competitors.
Yeah.
So I was not thrilled as a true blue Sitka wolf to be entering Juneau bear country.
Mm-hmm.
So I was a little reluctant, but she was quite persuasive. And I ended up applying and coming here and getting a job at the Empire. And loving it, loving it, loving it, just as I'd loved my last newspaper job. And then one day going to an assembly meeting for a reporter who was out of town, couldn't make the meeting, and meeting a guy there who was covering the assembly for a commercial radio station. And the guy who normally covered wasn't able to make it, so we were both at the same meeting, and he was awfully cute. So that's the guy I ended up marrying, Ed Schoenfeld.
And what does Ed bring to the work for you?
Ed is the person who gives us the setting of our stories.
Mm.
So we just right now just completed a presentation that we're going to be giving on a shooting in Tenneke.
Mm-hmm.
And so what Ed's done is an enormous amount of research on hot springs throughout the world and hot springs in Alaska and Tenneke, how it was created, and it's the indigenous population who were there and what they named it. And that's what he brings to it. It's just this enormous amount of research into this community, the community that we're placing our story in, and the time. Our last presentation's on Ketchikan in the 1940s, and he and I were talking about Ketchikan having a reputation as a place where bad men would move to Alaska.
Mm.
And in this particular case, that was actually absolutely true. A guy who'd just gotten out of the state penitentiary in Washington hitches a ride up to Ketchikan and meets another friend of his from the penitentiary, and they get up to no good. So we were talking about why was that? Was there something about Ketchikan that drew people, or was it simply the cheapest ticket to get to Alaska, and that was the place they were escaping to? And what was happening after World War II with men? Where did they go, veterans? So that's the sort of work that he does. It's fantastic.
I love that, creating the environment, mm-hmm. you really understand. Because I think that is part of it. Like, what is
absolutely.
The understanding the place? And like you were loving in Sitka, the idea of, like, what's happening economically, socially? How is the town made up? And what is drawing people there?
And what created the circumstances that led to this particular killing?
Yeah.
You know, because the motives for killing remain the same. You know, it's money, it's sex, it's, you know.
Jealousy. Yeah.
It's, right. They're pretty straightforward. But the setting in which those things happen, where you have, and I can think of a case here in Juneau, two women who were running their own business downtown as prostitutes and ended up being beaten and robbed by a man who was broke.
Mm.
He was just broke, and he saw them as easy victims, and they were. But that happened at a time and in a place in a way that would not happen today, simply because the women were so vulnerable and they didn't recognize that.
Right.
Understandably, they didn't recognize it.
We'll take a quick break. I'm talking with author and true crime enthusiast Betsy Longenbaugh. You can find more information on upcoming presentations and talks and her books at truecrimealaska.com. This is Juneau Afternoons, Rainy Day Conversations.
Support from Hanson Gress. Seeking curious people who like technology, network engineering, and customer support. Opportunities for those who thrive on problem solving. Details at hansengress.com/careers.
This is Juno Afternoon from KTOO. Let's continue our Rainy Day conversation with true crime author Betsy Longenbaugh. Warning, this talk does include adult topics around murder, sexual assault, and other criminal activity. I'd love to talk about your writing process in terms of this first book. I know you have you've written two. The third one is now finished. We'll talk about that one in just a little bit. But this first one is a nonfiction book, mm-hmm. Forgotten Murders from Alaska's Capital. And you had mentioned that you had found – you have a database of about 80 cases mm-hmm. So far mm-hmm. and that you've uncovered. And this book covers 10 of those. Mm-hmm. So – let's talk about some of the ones that you put in there. Why did you put them in there? I know you mentioned the first, you know, the first serial killer that we know of anyway.
Right, right.
First recorded, I guess, serial killer, because there were probably others.
Oh, I'm sure there were, yes.
But can you tell us a little bit about that one that is in there and then maybe a few of the other ones?
Well, I was looking for stories that had a satisfactory resolution. There's nothing I hate more than hearing about a story or a case that now we're still looking and trying to figure out who's. No, I'm not interested in that. I want a resolution. Maybe it might not be the resolution I think it should be, mm-hmm. but at least there's something there that I can speculate on and grab hold of. And that particular case, the one about the serial killer, kind of snuck up on me. I can't even remember how I first read about it. It was definitely when I was doing that first overview. And initially, he had been working in impunity. He'd been living in Petersburg, disappearing people, disappeared somebody out of Tenneke, disappeared somebody out of Ballard down in Seattle, and would end up owning their real estate and have their bank books and have their boats and two young men who were caretakers down at a mine in Ketchikan. The $1,000 they'd just been paid for putting together a log raft, their dog, their gun, and their boat all disappeared. And the person who was closest to them, our killer, was not interested in searching for them like everybody else in the community was doing. So he had a reputation. He'd been operating for a number of years. And it wasn't until he came to Juneau and disappeared two men who belonged to the same fraternal organizations who were very unhappy about these two men missing and consequently hired a Pinkerton detective. And that person was able to put together the evidence that was needed to actually convict somebody who had never left behind a body, never left behind any physical evidence. There was never a body found.
So now in the reporting, this is fascinating. In the reporting, were people speculating that these cases were the same person or they were? Okay, so they knew that somebody was doing because the MO was similar?
Well, by the time he was a suspect in Juneau, he had been physically identified by witnesses who saw him with the victims. And he had at that point kind of a shady reputation, as you can imagine. I mean, people were wary of him. Although people in Petersburg said he was very, very polite with the ladies, very well-read, astute guy. And by this time, he's in his 40s. We are pretty convinced that he disappeared eight men here in Alaska.
Wow.
And he had been around for a long time before he hit Alaska. So I think it had been going on for quite some time. I think he was very, very good at what he did. But I can tell you that after his arrest, there were lots of speculations about every missing person ever having been traced back to him, including a local German baker who just disappeared until he telegraphed back from Germany saying he was there with his family and everything was okay. So just like today, there's you know, lots of wild speculation whenever there's something as horrific as a serial killer operating.
Now, how do you take those details? Because you're uncovering all this stuff through microfiche and through mm-hmm. these databases that you've discussed and things like that. So you get all these details. And then how do you turn that into a story?
I think part, for me, part of the process is simply chronological. Mm. I'll sort of start with where was – that story was hard to tell because it is sort of scattered all over the place. You know, where did he come from? Where was he living before he ended up in Juneau? And in the particular case in Juneau, one of the two men that he disappeared was not his typical victim. Mm. He would disappear men who had no immediate family who were going to miss them. They had jobs that were either remote or variable, like commercial fishermen. That was somebody he really liked to go after. Mm. But one of the two men he killed here in Juneau, it appears that he killed because he had just married a woman that the killer was very interested in.
Ah, I see.
They'd literally been married for 2 weeks when he picked up the guy and took him off in his boat, and he was never seen again.
So do you find in chronological order, mm-hmm. you sort of begin,
mm-hmm.
and then do threads or themes start to emerge in the stories, or?
Yeah, I just end up doing a lot of digging,
yeah.
and then things happen. And what I've discovered, the digging about the people involved is how those threads come together.
Mm, okay.
So in that particular case, digging about the fact that this one guy he walked off with and was never seen again was married, that was unusual. And there was suspicion at the time that she may have been involved, and that was quickly quashed. Her first husband had also died quite suspiciously.
Mm.
She said that the killer had never made any overtures to her. I think that's probably true. I just think he was a very, very, very sick person, as we would say today. I think it was somebody who became obsessed with her and decided he needed to take out this new husband.
Wow.
Anyway, he left her a second time widow with two young kids. And so what happened to her? Don't you want to know? Of course you do.
Yeah.
She remarried somebody in Sitka, uh-huh. and they ended up moving to Seattle. She lived to a ripe old age and is buried in Seattle.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, and that's what's so great about it is to be able to follow those threads. Because I know, obviously, your journalism background and even your social work background plays all into that.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know for journalists, you're sometimes asking the question, right? You're
right.
Like, because that's what you're doing is always asking questions
and trying to figure out the story.
Yeah, the story.
Because it's not just enough to say somebody was killed.
Right.
Why? Why were they killed?
Yeah.
And who killed them? And what circumstances led to that? What was the motivation behind it? What was the act itself? Were there people who saw it? Were there people who suspected it? And those are story elements.
Mm-hmm.
For us, because we choose historic murder, we're in the luxurious position of finding out what happened afterward.
Right.
What happened to those people who were left behind? We can usually find out. And that, to me, is one of my favorite parts of the story, is finding out what happened afterward, what happened to those folks who were left behind.
When you're uncovering microfiche, newsletters, but you're also probably finding letters and documents and things that are people have created maybe that might be documented somewhere along the way. And I know you're not doing current day, true crime, but it is interesting to me because I think about this. Nobody writes letters anymore. What they're writing is emails that then get lost in the ether.
Isn't that interesting? I've thought about that too. And the number of newspapers that are disappearing.
Yeah.
Which is really the fount of our knowledge is newspapers.
It's like the document of a town,
it
right?
Absolutely is.
Yeah.
And it tells you so much about the events and the setting that you're in and what else is happening in the community. And without that parameter, without those boundaries, it's pretty hard to know the story.
Especially in these smaller towns.
Yeah,
right?
The disappearance of newspapers has me gravely concerned, both personally as a former reporter, I love doing it, and also how do we create community without that thing in common. So it is really interesting both to look at the documents that we see in the newspaper. We also use Ancestry. I use Ancestry.com to find out about people.
Mm-hmm.
But the other big source for us are the court records.
court records.
And all the territorial court records. I've heard firsthand accounts of people saying that before the old courthouse was torn down, there were literally stacks of paper in the attic, sort of floating around. So there were a few cases where they gathered everything together because they were well known. The Birdman of Alcatraz is one of them. That was something that the book came out, the movie came out right around statehood. They kept all those court records. The court records about our serial killer, that was a big, big deal here in Juneau. They kept those court records. But many, 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 many of the stories that we've looked at might have one or two pieces of paper in the court file. Maybe the jury decision, maybe the jury instructions from the judge. And once a blue moon, we'll come across an amazing collection. You'd mentioned letters. It's unusual for us to find letters.
Okay.
But the story in Ketchikan actually has the letter in it that the killer gave to the Coast Guard commander in Ketchikan, telling him to go look on this boat. Somebody's hurt. And whether it's deliberately misspelled or it was written by an illiterate person or both, it's a little hard to tell. But it's pretty intriguing to open up a file and see that. And there's a notorious case here in Juneau that a woman up in Anchorage, a former reporter, a former lawyer, is writing a book about, of two black men, the two last men who were hanged for murder here in Juneau. They were both black. They were hanged for the same crime. And the key piece of evidence was a forged check. And the first thing you see when you open up that court file is that forged check.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so you come across these just sort of spine-tingling moments sometimes with those court records. But like I say, more likely they're just going to be things you're going to have to kind of
wade through.
Yeah, subpoenas for different witnesses. And some of that's helpful. The jury instructions from the judge can be extremely informative, especially in cases of self-defense, because I've now written about three different cases that involved acquittals due to self-defense of armed men killing unarmed men and being acquitted for self-defense.
Armed men killing unarmed men, and they're considered self-defense.
Right. The most outrageous one, I'm just going to say it, happened here in Juneau. It was an older guy. He was in his 80s. He was living downtown, and his son sounds like an alcoholic, would show up drunk. And that night, an acquaintance from the bar hauled the son up to the residence, and the old man shot him.
Wow. Did they know why?
Well, he felt he was being threatened.
Oh.
And he was acquitted.
Interesting.
Yeah. So in part he was acquitted because the judge's instructions to the jury would say things like, it's not that they have a weapon at the time, it's that they fear for their life at that moment. So you don't have to prove the guy had a gun. You just have to prove that he frightened the other person enough. I don't know quite what would happen today if that
kind of case would hold up.
Right.
Yeah, that's
right.
Interesting. Now, your first book covered murders here in the capital city.
Mm-hmm.
Your third book, and we're going to talk about your narrative in just a second here, but your third book is another 10 cases that you've uncovered, but you've expanded the reach. What is the title? Do we know the title of the third book?
No, I'm thinking
we don't have
maybe
a title yet?
No, maybe Forgotten Murders of Southeast Alaska, except there are so many that we don't know. So we've included some great stories from Juneau, which we just had to because they are so amazing, as well as a story from Tenneke, Sitka, and Ketchikan.
And when do you anticipate this third book possibly being published? You said it's done?
Next year. It's done. The manuscript's done. And at this point, I'm giving it to friends and acquaintances who are willing to read it.
I see.
And so right now I have a very distant cousin in Sitka who is proofreading it and copy editing it. And
nice.
She's fantastic.
And are you working with a publisher on these?
Yeah.
Both
books have been published by Epicenter Press. And I'm hoping this one will be also. Epicenter is originally an Alaska press, and it's now moved down to Washington and does a lot of regional stuff. They've also acquired a couple of other little publishing houses, one of which just focuses on doing mysteries.
And I'm always interested in the business side of things. Mm-hmm. So when you were putting that book together, did you know people at Epicenter and that's how you reached out? Or how did you get it published?
How did I get it published? I had done some reading about how to submit manuscripts, and you're only supposed to submit to one publishing house at a time. Mm. So you submit, and once it's declined, then you can submit it again. So I'd submit it to Epicenter because I was aware, I was familiar with them. I used to review books and news as part of a newspaper when I was working at the newspaper. So I was knew that they did a lot of Alaska books, and both fiction and nonfiction. So it seemed to me sort of a natural fit to send it off to Epicenter. And then I sat around waiting to find out if they would accept it. And what I got in the mail was a contract.
So that was obviously a positive.
So and that's what sort of happened with the second book too. So, and I talked about self-publishing. It's something that a lot more people are doing nowadays for all kinds of really good reasons. But we personally just didn't want to have to be in the position of marketing it.
We'll take a quick break. I'm talking with author and true crime enthusiast Betsy Longenbaugh. You can find more information on upcoming presentations and talks and her books at truecrimealaska.com. This is Juno Afternoon's Rainy Day Conversations. Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com. This is Juno Afternoon from KTOO. Let's continue our rainy day conversation with true crime author Betsy Longenbaugh. Warning, this talk does include adult topics around murder, sexual assault, and other criminal activity. Now, you mentioned the second book, which is a narrative, Death in the Underworld, an Alaska murder mystery. Now, this is based on a true story?
It's based on a true story that had a very unsatisfactory ending. So my ending is much more satisfactory.
So tell us a little bit about the story of this one.
Well, it's covered actually on our Douglas walking tour, and it's going to be in the new nonfiction book. It's a story of another prostitute in Douglas who was savagely beaten and killed and robbed, but in a weird way. The cases that we've come across of prostitutes being killed, it's always been for their money. And usually wherever it is they were living has just been ransacked and everything of value taken. But in this particular case, the cash was gone, but the place wasn't really torn apart. It's just she had been brutally attacked. So, of course, I read about this case, and I thought, well, that's really interesting. And so I had done a lot of research on it, and I was ready to go forward. And one of the staff at the State Historic Library came up to me and handed me a newspaper article about the killing that I had never seen. It came out of an Anchorage newspaper. And this is in 1917. Anchorage was little more than a railroad station up there. I mean, a railroad camp. And so I was shocked. And then I read it and realized that the reporter, the very enterprising reporter in Anchorage, had actually interviewed colleagues, other prostitutes in Anchorage about this young woman, and had this story of her having been part of a sex trade operation run out of South America.
Wow.
And I read this and I thought, boy, somebody's having fantasies beyond their imaginings. So I started doing some research, and absolutely true. Absolutely true. There was a sex slave operation working out of Buenos Aires from around the 1880s until the Second World War. They focused on Jewish girls, young girls, 12, 13, 14. They would send their guys, these Jewish men, would go over to these extraordinarily poor regions of Eastern Europe where Jews had been displaced because of the prejudice against them, and meet a young girl and convince her parents that he was a rich American, that was the line, and he wanted to marry her. So they would so-called get married. She'd end up on a ship with maybe two other girls. Mm. He'd take them to Buenos Aires, and basically after that, they were in servitude. It's just an absolutely horrifying story. And so I realized it was true, which then put a whole new – and in this case, this girl had been sent by her procurer up to Anchorage. And she got fed up with him. This is what the women up there told the reporter, that she was tired of sending him money. She didn't want to have anything to do with it anymore. So she threw away her wedding ring and decided that divorced him, which was probably true since he'd never really been legally married, and was getting ready to escape when he shows up in Anchorage.
Oh.
So they ended up back here, and he's almost certainly the person who killed her.
They ended up back in Juneau.
Mm-hmm. As he took her from Anchorage down here to basically make some money. And according to the newspaper, when she showed up here in Juneau, she had $3,000, which was an absolute fortune.
That would be a lot of money.
A lot of money.
Yeah.
And all of it was gone after she died. And it's almost certain that he killed her, but he had an alibi witness. Another young man who said they'd spent the night in the same bed, which sounds very lascivious from us now, but at the time would have not been unusual for boarding houses. It was just something, you know, just something to make the stay a little cheaper. It's almost certain that he bribed the man to lie for him because that was part of the whole Buenos Aires operation was bribery. They bribed immigration officials and judges and police. Anybody who might have contact with those young girls was bribed to shut up. So almost certainly this young guy was bribed. The community, I think, believed that he had killed her because he was indicted for acts against the White Slavery Act is what they call it, charges against the White Slavery Act. And convicted to a year and a day in a federal prison. And since then, I've understand, and I don't know enough about this to say for sure, but that conviction of adding a day to the year actually turned it into a more serious case.
Oh. Okay.
In terms of how he would be seen in the future, basically more of a felon than a misdemeanor. So I think people knew that he did it. They just couldn't prove it.
So when you were writing the novel...
Mm-hmm.
You said it had an unsatisfactory
yeah,
ending.
Yeah, that's an unsatisfactory ending. They didn't convict anybody for killing her.
Are you using the names of these people in the book? How did you make it from a non... I guess I'm curious about how you made it from a nonfiction to a fiction.
There were some people involved in law enforcement here in Juneau, specifically that Pinkerton detective I mentioned earlier, was still here, and he at that point had become a deputy federal marshal. And I have such admiration for him. So I plucked him into the story because he's a fascinating character. And I also put into the story a couple of other characters that we've come across, including Alaska Native woman, that we've come across in our research. And then, of course, it had to happen in Douglas because that's where I'm from. But I didn't want to put it in the year it actually happened because that was the year the mine flooded. And that would have overwhelmed the story. So I placed it in the previous year. So a lot of it's the same. A lot of it's different. I've added other women who were close friends to hers. We know there was one woman who was a close friend of hers. And she's in there, but there's also another woman. So it's the people who end up resolving this story pretty much are women.
And you talked about theme being, you know, and finding the story.
Mm-hmm.
And so how did you tell this story? Is it from first person, third person?
Oh, it's third person.
Third person.
There's one sort of particular passage when you're hearing what's going on in the killer's head.
Mm.
He's being, at that point, he's being taunted by a little boy who fools him completely. It's one of my favorite characters in there is this little boy named George who... is quite mischievous and quite bright and turns out to be a threat to the killer, and he tries to do away with him, and George, with his smarts, escapes.
Nice.
So, yeah.
And this book just came out in 2025, right?
Yeah.
Came out in January of 2025. And because you took this story and made it wrapped up an ending that is more satisfying, I'm just curious, are you seeing others of these cases that you're working on that you might say, hey, I'm going to do this again with another story?
Well, actually, I did write a second novel last year when I went to Sitka. I've been going over to Sitka and working for just a month, and I'd sit over there and can't really do much besides write, go for walks, and visit my aunts, so who are both very busy people. So I end up just doing lots and lots of writing. And so the last book I wrote had a lot of the same characters from that first book. It's sort of a, if there were a series, it'd be series number, it'd be number two in the series. But the murder this time was set at St. Anne's Hospital because I really wanted to do a murder set in a hospital, which actually we haven't come across because I'm sure no coroner's jury in a world would have said that was a murder if it happened in a hospital.
Right.
So I have a deputy marshal who's in the hospital himself from circumstances involving the first book, and here's a murder happening in the bed next to him.
Oh,
and then it rolls on from there.
So is that one going to be coming out?
I don't know. I have a lot of work to do on it still. I wrote it, but it needs polishing, and I'm still mulling around different threads of the plot in my head.
I love that you are so open, and you have a great Facebook presence. You also have the website, truecrimealaska.com, where you document everything that you're doing in terms of the novels, as well as the tours and the walking tours that you do. Throughout, you do some in the winter and some in the spring and in the summer and stuff like that, which is really great. And you posted a picture, which I thought was so funny because it was basically you in the middle of your research period.
Right.
And you sort of have like a breakfast bar and there's documents and papers. And because I can imagine that, yeah, you've probably got it all cataloged on the computer. In terms of PDFs from these microfiche or whatever.
Oh, but you I print out volumes of things. I'm not saying
out.
They're not on the computer, but I want the paper in front of me. I'm really bad that way.
No, because it's like you see, it's like one of those old movies where the detectives are putting together the different pieces of paper.
Exactly.
And you're like, oh, let me grab this one. There was that note about
and
XYZ.
That is exactly what I do.
Yeah.
So I'll print out, for example, a census report from Ancestry.com about a particular person, and then I'll handwrite on it things I come across that are related to that person.
Mm.
And so that's how these things sort of end up becoming lots and lots of paper. The Sitka place where I go to write is a little teeny tiny studio that Ed and I own. And the only place that you can even sit is at that breakfast bar, much less work. So that's my working spot.
That's pretty funny. And I do want to mention you have the best place to find out the current upcoming talks is at truecrimealaska.com.
Mm-hmm.
You document them all. Some are fundraisers for Church of the Holy Trinity. Some are done for the city.
The walking tours are for the city.
Yeah,
and the presentations are all for the church.
Gotcha. And the best place, again, to go find those is at truecrimealaska.com or follow Betsy's Facebook page. Betsy Longenbaugh, what a pleasure to talk murder, mystery, details, writing, how you put it all together. It really has sort of occupied the last 6-7 years of your life. And do you see it continuing on for many more years to come?
I don't know. You know, I didn't think it would take this long. And there are lots of other things going on in my life, which is why I'm forcing myself to go to Sitka to do that writing. I suspect it's something that's going to continue to be of interest to me because people are interested in it and because I have an opportunity to remind folks of these many times women who have disappeared from our history and were victims. So they're being re-victimized, particularly in Douglas where the city cemetery is in such shambles. You don't know who's buried where. So I think that that's, I guess if I'm going to leave you with a point, is that I want to remember those people. I want to remember the women, and in this case, the child, the men, those people who died way too young under horrific circumstances because of someone else's evilness or selfishness or whatever it is. They killed fear. That's the part that I find the most solace in when I get really down and upset about writing these stories is the fact that I am reminding people that these people lived.
Gunnath Cheese for being here.
Yeah,
I really appreciate
for having
it.
Me.
Yeah, it was such a pleasure. Betsy Longenbaugh, Rainy Day Conversations here on Juno Afternoon. That will do it for today's Rainy Day Conversation on Juno Afternoon. Juno Afternoon airs Wednesday through Friday at 3 p.m. right here on KTOO Juno 104.3 and KAUK Juno Auk Bay 91.7. Find the show online at ktoo.org/JunoAfternoon, where you can listen to episodes, subscribe to the podcast, offer feedback or suggestions, or find out how to be a guest on the show. Our theme music is by Indian Agent. Programming support for Juno Afternoon comes from listeners and viewers like you and Alaska Airlines Club 49, Hanson Gress, and Heritage Coffee Roasting Company. Juno Afternoon is a project of the KTOO Arts and Culture team. I'm Boston Christopher, producer and host of the program. Gunath Chish, Hawa, Toksik Nusum, Salamat. Thank you for listening.